Welcome to Credit Exchange, your weekly podcast where we speak to the biggest newsmakers and news shapers in finance. I'm your host, Lisa Lee. This week, my guest is John Dorfman, Chief Investment Officer at Napier Park Global Capital, a $40 billion alternative credit manager. He's here with us to help us unpack one of the most difficult times in investing, or at least that's the way it seems to me. Welcome, John. John, this has been, and I seem to say this every week, a historical time for markets. We had oil prices rocket up over $100 a barrel to near 120, a historical rise, only for it to fall back when President Donald Trump said the war with Iran will be over very soon. Oil prices are now below 90 as we tape on Tuesday, March 10th. And that's just oil. There's just massive volatility and uncertainty. We have no idea how long this war might last, what the consequences are for inflation, for international trade. On top of that, we have AI disruption. We have software companies that people are losing confidence in. Just a tumult of activity. As a CIO and someone who's been doing this for decades, how do you view this landscape?
I think this landscape is consistent with a change in the investment environment in credit. So we went into 2026 with extremely compressed credit spreads, a lot of risk in the system, and not enough compensation for the risk investors are taking in credit. So like from our point of view, you know, probably about a year ago, we de-risked our portfolios and basically came out with a rather cheesy phrase that caution is the new conviction, because we were really concerned about lack of compensation in credit, combined with the fact the marginal price setter had switched from institutional capital to retail capital and insurance capital on a rated basis with lesser known rating agencies. So how this has played out this year, which is rising volatility, rising spreads, bouts of volatility, is not even remotely surprising. The cause is certainly surprising since no one can predict a war.
Yes, that is a completely unpredictable. I don't think it was telegraphed, and it caught people very much by surprise. And I don't think we understand exactly what the purpose of this war is, or how long it might last, or the global consequence. Do you have any sense of how to make sense of this?
Well, I think the way we think about it is, what is the actual effect of a war like this on investing? And the easiest way to think about it is the entire investment community has become short-term oil traders, or oil watchers is probably a better way to frame it. But typically what happens is, that historically, whenever you have a major geopolitical development like this, markets usually have a short-term, very violent downward move with some type of capitulation, and then they recover. It is very unusual for geopolitical events to affect markets other than the short term. And when we've looked at previous energy-related issues with rising oil prices like this, I think the easiest way to think about it is you need to have sustained high oil prices for at least a few months for it to meaningfully affect the real economy and therefore financial markets. So short-term violence like this in terms of oil pricing and the swings we're seeing, it's not going on long enough. I think it's been 6 or 7 business days. It's not been long enough to really affect markets and or the real economy. So from our point of view, it's most likely this will pass, but we still feel markets aren't taking at face value what could be an extended conflict. You know, the market reaction has been it will not be an extended conflict.
That's true. Because I look at the S&P, I look at equities as a barometer of risk, and they've been relatively sanguine. Yes, they've sold off to some degree, but not to what you would expect from a major war. And also it's rebounding back. There's a real sense that this might taco again, the idea that Trump always chickens out. I'm not so sure you can chicken out of a war that you started with a partner that now is fighting for regime survival. So do you think, and maybe you alluded to this a little bit before, that people are a little too sanguine about how quickly and easily we can extradite ourselves from this.
Well, yeah, I do. I think it can go in one of two ways. Either the government can say, look, our objective was to eliminate their offensive capabilities, and we've done that. End of war. That's kind of one way it could go. The other way it could go is a much more sustained conflict. And it's not clear which way it's going to go, but clearly markets are saying that it's going to go quickly. And we think there should be more kind of risk premium priced in case it doesn't. Mm-hmm.
And why do you think that is? Why do you think there is this sense that this will be over very soon? Is it the retail money? Is it sort of the past year and a half of top people that it's best to buy on the dip? Because I don't understand why there is such a sense for markets who are not geopoliticians, who don't understand some of the conflict in the Middle East, who don't understand this new leader, that they think this will be over so soon and with so little consequence.
I think it's two things. I think buy the dip has been an unusually successful strategy the last few years. So there's no question, every time the market sells off and people buy, they've been rewarded to do so. And that also predates the current administration, but it's certainly been the case over the last couple of years. So that's one reason. I think the other reason, which is probably the more important reason, is the U.S. economy in particular is benefiting from both fiscal and monetary stimulus that happened last year, but affects the economy this year. So what do I mean by that in English? What I mean is the Fed cut rates, it takes effect with a lag. So that's going to begin to take more effect this year. It also affects sentiment this year. Fiscal stimulus with the One Beautiful Bill increases GDP by just under 1%. That's a huge number for an economy whose baseline growth is 2 to 2.25%. So you have simultaneous stimulus occurring in the largest economy on earth. And you know, the old saying used to be, when the US sneezes, the world catches a cold. And I think now it's the reverse. When the US economies run hot, everyone benefits. But it's the same idea. When you have this much stimulus in the largest economy in the world, the bottom line is the economy is in good shape. And so that's the other reason that there's this kind of mentality of, aha, if assets are cheaper, I should buy because everything's fine.
And do you think that this might be the time when people learn that that might not be the best strategy to always take? Because you're right, it has been a winning strategy over and over again. I think since the financial crisis, just buy the dip. People have been conditioned so far. Is this might be the time that people learn their lesson? Because that, definitely after the Liberation Day and those tariffs, everyone who stayed in or bought the dip benefited so much. Equities, the US equity markets are on fire. And have been. And then when you look at the globe, to your point, it's not just the US. European and Asian stock markets have actually outperformed the US, mostly driven by the fact that the US is running hot. Could this be the time that people learn that maybe this is, you can't always use one strategy all the time?
I think it's too early to tell, because this much stimulus and combined with a very weak dollar until obviously the last couple of weeks, should be resulting in higher future inflation later this year and next year. That hasn't happened yet. So I think it's when we're at the point where that inflation is more visible and it becomes clear that there just isn't going to be the political appetite for more fiscal stimulus or the Federal Reserve appetite for more monetary stimulus. That's when the buying the dip will really prove to be a bad strategy. But right now, it's too early. This will probably be another buy the dip, you're fine, in all probability.
So we should all be buying the dip, at least for the near term.
Well, it's not much of a dip is
know,
the problem.
That's the problem, right? I wish I could buy the dip. There is really no dip. But let's talk, since you mentioned the Fed, I do think that this what's going on with oil prices and the uncertainty around oil and what it might do to inflation now ties the hand of a Fed that looked more and more like they were going to have some rate cuts. How does that impact the way you think about stocks, credit, the fact that the Fed and also maybe other central banks around the globe who were poised to cut and were cutting might now be stalled because there's too much uncertainty?
I think our general view entering this year was spreads would be continuously widening in a mild manner through the course of the year. So moderately, you know, and there's going to be times during that they tighten, but that generally there just be these constant events that cause risk premiums to go up. There's just going to be another one. This is another one, right? There's a lot of them that we see happening this year that will cause wider spreads over the course of the year.
So it could very well be that Trump doesn't get what he seems to most want, which is a lower interest rate environment. Could that be actually be better for risk assets in some ways?
Well, I think so, because it certainly would give the Fed more ammunition in the future if they need it, if there's an economic slowdown. And right now, the economy really doesn't need to have lower rates. That's not really necessary.
And it could also be like there was a lot of questions about Fed independence. And so if the Fed doesn't cut because inflation looks to be rearing its head, it sort of tells the world and the markets, hey, we're independent, because that definitely was something that was being questioned. And I think that just would be really horrible for markets if we no longer believed in the Federal Reserve.
I think that's right, because the U.S. is the world's reserve currency. And so the more independent the central bank is, the more that reserve currency status is kept. So it has a big currency effect if there's a belief by investors outside the United States that you no longer have an independent central bank.
But, you know, to your point, the economy is doing really well, but some of the latest data points to a weaker than expected labor market. We're not hiring as much. We're laying off more. The labor market just seems sort of just belies the fact that the rest of the economy is doing so well. What's the consequence of that? And for one, how could that even happen? How could the economy be so strong when the job picture is mediocre to weak?
You know, we've been talking about this for the last couple of years, and now it's widely known as the K-shaped economy, which is you have, you know, the higher half of the income bracket doing well and the lower half doing poorly. And I think the risk to the system is there's a statistical correlation that's been studied by the Fed and also by a lot of economists as to why the top half, and in particular, the top 10% spend. And a lot of it is tied to net worth. So weirdly enough, if someone's net worth goes up, they spend more, even if they don't change their net worth, or they don't sell stocks to spend. So there is a risk that because the economy is propped up by only a subcomponent, i.e. the higher net worth side, if you see major asset price declines in equities, that's going to affect consumer spending and slow down the economy. So that's what I see the risk there. But in the meantime, between corporate CapEx, corporate new business growth, and the spending habits of the top half of the consumer, that's outweighing, you know, in particular, what you can see in credit, which is high prime delinquencies, high subprime delinquencies, high near prime delinquencies, a lot of areas in trouble. All that other areas outweigh that.
And so let's move on to credit. Credit spreads were too tight. It is widening. It seems more appropriate to the market, because I do think for a while we had spreads that were tighter than they should be and more reflective of the technicals, the lack of supply, than of the general investing climate or the economy. Are they more appropriate now, or are they still too cheap and we need to widen further?
I think my view is they should be wider. I think so, yeah. However, within that, there are some credits that obviously should be tighter. So the market as a whole in the non-investment grade side, I feel, should be wider. But there's certainly specific situations that are oversold. But I think we have to realize some of the flows that we've seen over the last couple of years, like these enormous wealth-related yield flows, are reversing. So these are all levered vehicles. These are not unlevered vehicles. And so as they reverse, that causes two things. It causes asset sales. So that helps with some of the supply shortage that's existed relative to demand. And the other thing is it creates NAV declines, which creates more asset sales. And then, of course, institutions start looking and saying, you know, we're starting to experience losses. Maybe we should sell too, particularly if the economy shifts into a slower growth environment. So I think it's going to naturally happen by the outflow cycle that we're seeing. I would also say, you know, we had a wall of money looking
for yield. Yeah, we did.
Mm-hmm. And it was particularly started after 2022 when base rates were really high and spreads were really high. So most investors realized, hey, we can get double-digit returns in credit that's fairly certain. Why wouldn't I do that? But borrowers weren't willing to issue at 10 to 12%. So you had a supply shortage. And what's really changed is 2025 was a huge new issuance year in almost every single asset class. So whether it's just core corporate bonds, leveraged loans, RMBS, obviously CLOs, it was a record new issuance and reset year in CLOs. There's just a great environment until very recently to be an issuer. And so, you know, spreads were lower and base rates were lower. So part of that supply-demand imbalance has been satisfied through very heavy issuance. And still, like sitting here right now, there still is enormous demand on the investment grade side, less so on the, you know, more risky side.
Investment grade, I think we've been having really big IG issuance that's clearing the market really well. That's expected to continue, we think. The IG market, investment grade market is strong, demand is strong. But let's switch to where the demand is weaker. First of all, the leveraged loan, the high yield bonds, also private credit, which has somehow commanded huge headlines. I'm not sure whether you agree with these headlines or not, but they've commanded headlines. It's almost like as though every single software loan is only backed by private credit. And when you talk about some of these wealth channel, they have really pushed into the wealth channel, right? Picking, selling their products to the affluent individual. Especially these non-traded BDCs that promised some form of liquidity, 5%. I'm not so sure. I was talking to an LP today, and she was saying that she does not think those were appropriate vehicles for individual investors, that they might have, it might have said in the fine print that there's only 5% limited redemptions, but people didn't really understand it. Talk to me a little bit about the wealth channel and what that's going on there.
So I think the simplest way to explain what's going on in the wealth channel is the headlines are feeding a nervousness about credit. And therefore, the wealth channel in the last 3 months of last year, the growth rate precipitously declined of net inflows. So generally between 10 to 50% kind of rate of decline, depending on the manager and the vehicle. Now it's actually net negative for 2026. Across every manager. Most have not reported yet, but you can kind of see by who's reporting, it's going to be a net negative through the system. That does not mean there's no subscriptions. It just means redemptions are higher than subscriptions. More disciplined managers that have liquidity and don't have to over-levered, it's going to be fine. There are going to be more and more asset sales like we've seen recently from BDCs that are running low liquidity and a lot of leverage. So we expect a lot of secondary private loans to come out. Generally, what gets sold are your better quality loans. So this doesn't create a systemic crisis. I think people will look back and say the headlines were overblown in terms of private credit losses. But specific to software, it's really appropriate. There's been a dramatic repricing because of the enormous uncertainty at each company level in terms of the effect of AI. And my own opinion is some of these companies, you know, they're run by very, very smart business people. So, you know, you can look at, if you want to go way back, you could look at IBM 25 years ago. their main business was physical computers. And they sold it to Lenovo, the Chinese company. At the time, people thought they were out of their mind. But it was a strategic decision by the most senior people there that it was going to become a commoditized product based on cost of labor. And that wasn't going to benefit them because they were an American company. It was completely the right decision. So my point is, the more sophisticated software companies that are well-managed are not going to sit still. They're going to figure out how AI benefits them, and they will come out stronger. And on the other hand, some won't. They will be, you know, quote unquote, eaten by AI, which is the new lingo floating around. So the difficulty is you never know which is going to be good.
That's my next question was, how do you figure that out? How do you parse that now with AI being still so early days and not knowing which management teams are going to be able to respond in a way that makes them winners? As in your R seat right now, can you even figure out the winners and losers?
Yes and no. So what we've done is divide the software companies into different types of necessity, for lack of a better word. So something that is absolutely essential enterprise software, it's a well-managed company, not over-levered, we're pretty comfortable, we'll be fine. Something that you can see could be done by AI, but it's not quite there yet, is running with a lot of leverage, and you're not so sure about the management. Those are the ones that we stay away from. You know, we were lucky because we went into this with very little software exposure. Like on the private side, it was under 1% of our exposure.
Oh, wow. That's really low, John. For some prior credit, they love software. How did you end up with so little?
I think the difficulty, one was the nature of what we do, which is we lend to lower middle market companies. And these companies were getting such high leverage multiples. They were becoming core middle market just by the nature of the amount of leverage that people were willing to lend. And then the other is much more related to the industry itself and the type of economics. When you're lending to smaller companies, that's not the best industry to lend to. You want to pick things that are less cyclical and more stable cash flow. Because there was a big bubble of very high leverage against, you know, recurring revenue. And the problem is recurring revenue is recurring till it isn't recurring. It's just not an area we particularly liked that much. And that's different than like a big public BSL trading at 99. That's fine. That company will be around, I don't want to say forever, but obviously if it's trading at 99 in this environment as a software company, you can conclude it's perfectly fine.
It is interesting because headlines, even accurate or not, does feed fear. And there's going to be a real world consequence when retail, especially individual investors, see that and pull money out. And then there is a feed loop, back loop, right? The more money you see withdrawals, I think withdrawals beget withdrawals, inflows beget inflows. And we're sort of in a outflow mode. And the market has never really had this period before. I'm very much aware that private credit has been around for a long time. I started my career out in private credit, but it has never endured raising huge sums of money in these non-traded vehicles that might be redeemed. What to you could be a plausible negative scenario with all these redemptions? I know you talk a little bit about it, there'll be asset sales beyond that.
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of vehicles that just say, look, it's contractually 5%, and that's what you're getting. Which just happened with one of the larger BDCs yesterday, you're going to see more of that. And that's going to beget more redemptions, to your point. So the most probable scenario is a relatively cold winter for corporate private credit in the wealth world. And that'll feed into the institutional world also because of sentiment reasons, because the losses actually aren't
no.
that high.
From what
as a system, they're not.
When I talk to the private credit guys, they're telling me the software companies are actually performing pretty well even to this point, that disruption has not yet happened. It's all just, you know, future.
I think this will be a lot like 4 years ago when the Fed took up rates. There was massive outflows from REITs, you know, real estate related, particularly commercial real estate related. investment vehicles that were levered, and they went through a really cold 2 year, at least probably two and a half year winter before investors were willing to invest again. I think this will be faster because not everyone has the same software exposure. Not everyone has the same leverage. It's a different industry than, you know, commercial real estate. So I think it'll be shorter, but I would expect this will go on for, could be one more quarter, could be three or four more quarters, but is not going to quickly resolve in a month or two.
And what you're saying is interesting too, that it will have ancillary effect in other markets, other credit markets, because the same headlines, people will start worrying. The people who start worrying about private credit will start looking, thinking, okay, what about leveraged loans? What about high yield bonds? What about other areas? How do you think it might play out? And how are you playing that?
Well, the way we're playing it is we have never had less directional risk in the history of the firm relative to the capital base we have. And we've never had more undrawn capital. So those, that should tell you where our heads are. And that predated the war. It predated the software crisis, for lack of a better word. So this is a position we've been in for the last 6-12 months. And that's our view, is this is going to become, you know, repriced over time. Could be more or less quickly, you never know. But the higher risk premiums are, the less people are willing to buy and the more prone markets are to blowups. So that's kind of how we're playing this.
Mm. Having lots of ready cash.
In terms of like
so it seems we have ready cash. Take advantage of this dislocation and the assets that are going to come for sale very soon.
Yeah, that's our view. And the cash is, you know, the capital we have is committed for a very long period of time. So it doesn't have to happen tomorrow morning. But I think we are going to see more and more problems occur and more bad headlines. So right now, every time a private credit loan is written down, it gets a headline.
Yes, it does. Right.
Which, you know, in the context of a $1.5 trillion, $2 trillion industry is somewhat ridiculous. Right. You don't see banks, X and such bank writes down $25 million loan.
Or we wrote down your mortgage of that one house on the street.
Exactly. But I do think it's not necessarily going to feed through to all credit markets, because what happens is more and more credit markets become uninvestable or more difficult to invest. It pushes all that capital into the other areas. And those other areas are things like investment grade, residential real estate in the United States. You know, there's areas that are completely untouched in terms of spread widening currently.
Oh, really? Tell me what, which ones?
This is really confined to corporates. Mm.
So real estate's fine. Everything else is fine. That's something I wanted to bring up. You are one of the innovators, pioneers of the credit default swap. Explain what exactly they are, how they've changed, and what they're telling you right now about the economy, about the general sentiment.
Yeah, so credit default swaps are the primary mechanism today that credit risk is transferred if you look at it by volume. And it starts with an investment grade index and a high yield index in the United States. They're exchange cleared, so that's why they can be traded in such huge volume. And I'd say over the last few years, more and more of the volume goes through algorithmic trading rather than humans. And that's really important because algorithms don't look at the underlying credits the way humans do. And what they are saying today is spreads are wider. They're about 10 to 20% of spread wider for kind of index level exposure. What they're saying today is a lack of fear about a recessionary environment and or a meaningful slowdown. So they're saying, look, risk premiums are higher, but they're not high in an absolute sense that are consistent with a slowdown.
And you agree with that? Do you think those market signals are correct? There isn't much risk of a recession, because coming back to sort of what we're talking about earlier.
I do agree with that. But I think the magnitude is what I don't agree with, in that probably spread should be more like 30% wider or 35, not 10 or 20. So you're talking about another 30 or 40 basis points wider as a generic high yield index. But the general idea that we are not in a recessionary environment and none of these issues are going to create a severe economic slowdown is the most probable outcome.
So if that's not your worry, what is your worry? Because that's the one question I know I always get an answer from my credit guys. What is your worry?
Yeah, well, you know, the problem with credit people like us is we can only get par back.
So you better worry.
It's an industry of worriers. Because if you don't worry, you're usually out of a job reasonably quickly.
In my entire time I've interviewed, only one guy ever said, I don't have a worry. And I was like, really? Should you be trading equities?
Yeah, of course, should be an equity guy. But I think what I worry about is resurgence of inflation over an intermediate period. I am not concerned over the next, you know, 2 or 3 months, but over an intermediate period, inflation resurgence is a significant risk.
And how much is the fear trade? Because that does sort of ram volatility, even though you're right, like we don't stay very long. We seem to sell off for a moment and then it's gone. But the credit markets, when you look at some perhaps leveraged loan prices, high yield bond prices, they've traded down and they've stayed down. Right.
And I would expect them to stay down. You know, we were looking at a portfolio of 30 or 40 different companies this morning that had gone down a lot, kind of thinking through, like, so what's our view? And our view generally is they'll probably go down further. And oddly enough, in December, we sold a very large portfolio, hundreds of millions of credit we were worried about. This is in the leveraged loan space. And we were worried they were still trading in the 80s and 90s. And a lot of those companies are now in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and 70s. I don't see that changing.
Yeah.
I really don't.
What
Those losses are there. They're real.
What happens when they have to refi? Because that's when the market has to worry, right? Like, will they be refinanceable? Because this market runs on not paying down the debt, but refinancing. And for a while, there was a sense that private credit will step in. I remember, like, when the private credit guys got very big, initially, they might take away our BSL loans. And then they're like, but they might refinance the one stuff that we don't want. Will private credit, you think, be still willing to step in given that they're overburdened with software? And if not, then where do these software companies refinance? And if they can't refinance, who bears the cost of that?
Well, most probable outcome for the companies that are decent, you're going to see a lot of amend to extend activity. So it's going to be all back to the amend and extend, which the current creditors will effectively, in return for a higher spread, extend the loan. Then there will be, that's one group. Then there'll be another group, which will be forced into LMEs, liability management exercises, which are effectively hostile forced exchanges with their creditors. So legally, it may be quote unquote voluntary at times, but the reality is it's a coerced exchange because the creditor is taking less than par. So you're going to have two groups, amend to extend group, LME group.
So lots of busy lawyers and restructuring professionals, even with the economy
pretty
well.
Yeah, I think that's where you want to be.
Yes, right. Yeah. That's a good time to be a restructuring lawyer. And right now, you've done this for many years. What are you particularly find exciting about investing in this current climate?
Well, over the last year, we have put most of our capital. We did a large rotation into residential real estate related risk out of corporate risk. That was over a year ago. That's where we have the strongest opinion currently. That remains unchanged. But we're a lot more interested in the corporate space now because the spread volatility is so high. So, you know, we looked yesterday and I think three of our four strategies are positive for the year and we kind of live off volatility. And on the private side, we live off careful underwriting, not having a recession like everybody else, and picking the right industries. So there's a lot of areas we think are really interesting currently.
So real estate is still your best trade, but you're getting more interested in corporate. Is that an accurate view?
Yeah, I think if you summarize in one sentence, yeah.
Great. Thank you so much. Is anything else you want to talk about? Because this has been a great conversation. I hate to cut it off, but we try to have these around 30 minutes.
No, I think I think we've covered everything.
Oh, great. Thank you so much, Don. This has been a great conversation, as always. I learned so much when I speak with you.
Thanks, Lisa. Appreciate it.
And to our viewers, thank you for joining us. And do follow us on Spotify and Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And we'll see you next week. This has been Lisa Lee.